Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I would also say, you know, bringing it to film, that when you get movies that do use temperature to enhance what they're doing, it can be really powerful. Like, it always brings to mind Do the Right Thing, the Spike Lee film, because it's on that really, really hot day.
Yeah.
And it kind of just adds to the tension of everything.
Yeah,
and,
you're right.
Really, really bolsters the film.
Yeah, it gives it a clammy sort of claustrophobic feel, doesn't it, when you watch the film? So, yeah, that is a good example of where the weather is used well in films, and it does work very well when you use it in the right way.
Likewise in Seven, when it's raining all the time, and it just makes you feel like the world is full of sin and horribleness.
I know. Does the job, doesn't it, really?
Does the job.
You know, there
it's like an extra character.
It's a mood control, isn't it, that directors can use now.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But we have a jam-packed show, as always, if I'm honest, because, Brian, you... Bless you, go off and do lots and lots of watching for us.
Yeah, I do my best.
If this is your first time listening to UK Film Club, welcome. And as you can probably already tell from the prattling that me and Brian engage with, it's a very casual affair. It's very lighthearted. But we will be covering lots and lots of different films because Brian goes and sees lots of films at the cinema, which he's going to review first. Then we'll do a big film from the streaming platforms. Then we've got a couple of shorts, indie short films, and then we'll finish up with what's called our nostalgia pick. And this month's nostalgia pick is a Tom Hanks film, Big, from 1988. Yeah. So we'll get to that. But first up on my list for you, Brian, was Hypnotic.
Oh, right. Okay.
Go on then.
Hypnotic. Let's get this one out of the way.
Oh, it's like that, is it?
A little bit. Yeah, it's a little bit. A bit of a milestone, this one. It's the first film I've reviewed on the podcast that I haven't actually liked. Chris, it didn't hypnotize me. I'm sorry. It's a bit early in the show to go for a terrible pun, but I thought, let's get it out of the way.
You know? I enjoyed that way too much.
Yeah. Anyway, directed by Robert Rodriguez, it stars Ben Affleck, Alice Braga, and William Fichtner. The storyline, as I understand it, anyone listening, please feel free to correct me, but here goes. Police detective Danny Rourke is in recovery following a series of emotional meltdowns. He tells a therapist how the disappearance of his daughter, Minnie, led to the breakdown of his marriage. He's judged fit for duty and joins his partner on a stakeout. They're watching a bank when an unknown individual begins to instruct those around him. A robbery appears to be in progress, but Rourke is drawn to a safety deposit box inside the bank. He finds a picture of his daughter with a simple message, "Find Lev Delarain." Rourke pursues the assailant as mayhem surrounds them, but somehow avoids his grasp. A series of mind-bending events lead into a psychic called Diana Cruz. They have an immediate connection and join forces to find Deloraine, who they believe holds the key to Minnie's disappearance. Okay, so that's the story, I think. There might be more to it than that. There might be less. It's dealing with alternate realities, the state of consciousness, fantasy, illusion. It might be in his head. He might be dreaming. But then again, maybe not. It tries to be clever, but it's just downright annoying. This is not why I go to cinema. Some people might, but me personally, this is not why I go. I came out with a really, really bad headache. It's not how I expect to feel. That's the kind of film it is. I think it's polarized opinion. Some people love it, others hate it. So it has Marmite qualities. But it, frankly, it didn't work for me. I wasn't feeling it. It just wasn't happening. It's just too difficult. It's too much hard work, really.
I mean, you look at the cast list and I'm thinking, you know, this should be all right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course.
I love William Fichtner. He's a classic. But it does have all the hallmarks of that type of film that, on paper, it probably sounds sort of fairly interesting. You know, like, okay, you know, we've got this set up. But the execution feels that maybe they've just absolutely bungled it. And from what you've said, it sounds as if you've come away feeling like that, then it's not the intended outcome.
Well, I think it has personality issues, the film itself, because, you know, does it want to be just a kind of a conventional thriller, a heist movie? Does it want to be a psychological sort of potboiler? It never quite makes its mind up. And I honestly think Ben Affleck looked confused at times, and he wasn't acting. I honestly think he's confused. What's happening here? You know, it's almost like he's kind of almost mentally reaching for the script again, as if to say, why are we doing this? What's my motivation? Why are we here? Now, again, it's going to be a film that divides opinion, but it's just not. I like to be challenged when I see a film, but I don't want to be confused either, and deliberately confused. It's just, it's trying to do too much at once. And to me, it misses the mark. It's a very well-made film, but any film with a decent budget now is going to be very well made. You know, it's going to be visually arresting. It's going to be impressive. But you tend to look for something a bit more. And this, for me, has something important missing because it's not an easy film to follow. But as I say, other people will have their views, which is fine.
Yeah, and if you're new to UK Film Club, please do feel free to send in your reviews of any films that we review, because Brian may not be right, you know. Brian has his opinion, and
that's fine.
I mean, good luck arguing with him, because I'm the only one who has access to Brian. Okay, but no, I think that's a fair, you know, your fair review of Hypnotic. It's in cinemas, I believe. So if you want to go watch that film, it's there. It's not doing particularly well in the old ratings, but hey, often, and I get told this a lot, critics are wrong. So hey,
I know.
Feel free to go and you know, tell us. So that was Hypnotic. Next up was the Aisling Bea starring film Greatest Days.
She is the star, yeah, pretty much. Yeah, Aisling Bea's the star. Okay then, so Greatest Days. This is directed by Cokie Goodrich, starring Aisling Bea, Alice Lowe, Jade Adams, and Amaka Okafor. This film is based on the musical of the same name, which is based on the songs of Take That. So, the story is as follows. 40-something nurse Rachel is anxiously awaiting the result of a radio competition. The prize is 4 tickets to watch her favourite group, The Boys, perform at a reunion concert in Athens. Much to her shock and delight, she wins, but is in something of a quandary. Her wannabe fiancé, Jeff, naturally assumes he will be on the plane, but Rachel sees it as a means of reuniting with her best friends, whom she hasn't seen in 25 years. We're told the story in flashback and learn what's happened in the girls' lives since then. Now, if you're a fan of Take That, it helps. If you're a fan of musicals, it helps. But even if not, you'll be carried along by the enthusiasm and positivity of the story, renewing friendships, rediscovering youth, connecting with the music we loved when we were growing up. It owes a lot to Mamma Mia, which acts as a template in many respects. But it, in other ways, the film has the edge over Mamma Mia because of the storyline. It's stronger, it's more cohesive, it's more feasible, and it gives it more of an edge because of that. I found it good, light-hearted fun, you know, really good fun, very enjoyable. It's really the antithesis of Hypnotic because it's not making you work at all. It's not making you think too much. So it is a bit like it's a musical on screen. You sense that, you feel it. So very enjoyable. Very enjoyable. Good fun. You'll like this. If you've got an open mind, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't classify myself as a Take That fan, but I get on board with some of their tracks. And I think, much like any kind of musical, I think if you go in with that sense of you're just going to have fun, forget yourself a little bit. Yeah, it looks like it's a good time. It looks like it's one of those easy switch off films.
Yeah, I'm not a particularly big fan of Take That. I think they've made some great pop records over the years. I am a huge fan of musicals on stage, though. I always feel that musicals lose something when they move onto the big screen. You lose the energy of the live performance. But I think Cokie Gedroych does a really good job and keeps the pot boiling, keeps it bubbling away. And you can't help but be taken in by it. And this is why I think there's a good analogy with Mamma Mia. It does a similar thing. You know, you get drawn in by it. It's just, you know, you come out of the film thinking, damn, I didn't really want to like that, but I did. I enjoyed it. It's good fun. You know, you think to yourself, I'm not going to like this, but it makes you like what you're seeing. And that's the secret of good filmmaking. You know,
one of the things for me with musicals is when they have no dialogue, when they're just purely music, that's when I don't really like them. Like that is... For me, it feels really contrived that they've had to like force everything into song.
Yeah.
And whereas I think when the music's done right and it kind of fits in and there's a good narrative that's shaped around it, then I'm fine with it. I think it works really well, you know, because it's a genre piece and it's adding to the experience for the viewer, but it's still presenting you with a story that sort of makes sense. So, weirdly enough, the one I didn't like a lot was Les Mis. With Russell Crowe one, which wasn't that long ago. Everyone loved it, but I watched it and I remember just thinking, oh, just stop singing for a bit. Yeah. Like, please just stop singing for a bit because I can't keep up this level of just watching you sing throughout. it didn't get me.
But you see, the thing is, when a musical is sung through where there is no spoken dialogue, and if I remember rightly, the film version didn't have any spoken dialogue, was it all sung through?
I think that's the example I always think of.
Yeah, right. So I think that could be the problem. It's the same thing with Evita, with Madonna. Sung all the way through, you don't break it down at all. It's just, and it feels suffocating in some ways because it's okay on stage when you're seeing it perform live. But on film, it kind of gets around you a bit too much. And you want some spoken dialogue because spoken dialogue enables you to follow the plot. The songs come in to give the plot some legs and to actually carry it forward, not where it just dominates the plot. And also, with any jukebox musical, which is what Greatest Days is, Mamma Mia is a jukebox musical, is that they often forget about a plot and a storyline. You know, if you look at the storyline for Mamma Mia, I think it was ludicrous, but with Greatest Days, they have thought about it a little bit and you think, right, okay, this could happen. You know, four girls at school, you know, growing up together, they love this boy band and it's what brings them all together. You know, that kind of makes sense and the storyline itself is more coherent. So they've made an effort. I like it when they make an effort rather than just copying out and thinking, right, we're just going to throw a lot of money at this piece and just stage individual songs. But it doesn't do that Greatest Days. So I think it deserves a lot of credit for that.
Fair enough. Just quickly, favourite musical of all time for me is South Park, the musical.
Oh, right.
Yeah, if you ever want to see a musical done right, South Park, the musical. I think they just absolutely nailed it. They really did.
It just goes to show, though, doesn't it, that musicals on stage and on film have moved on so far. They're not as rigid. They're not in a straitjacket the way they used to be. I mean, a musical had to be a cowboy serenading a girl in a gingham dress. You know, it's not like that anymore.
No.
You know, whilst that has its place, you know, you need to sort of extend that medium a bit more and make that genre breathe a bit more easily and not be so restricted. So the South Park example is a good one.
Staying within the musical confines, your next film. Now, I'm not going to try and pronounce this. It's like a French name. Let me try. Chevalier?
Chevalier.
I was way off.
Think Maurice Chevalier, the French entertainer, actor in the 40s and 50s. Chevalier. And apparently it means, this is something I learned from this film, it's the French equivalent to a knighthood. Chevalier. Oh. Yeah. Ooh. Did you know that? I didn't know that.
No, I mean, I'm still waiting for our knighthoods for services to...
Well, yeah, it'll come. Don't worry, it'll come. Bide your time. Okay, anyway. So, Chevalier, directed by Stephen Williams, starring Kelvin Harrison Jr., Lucy Boynton, and Samara Weaving. This is the true story of Joseph Bologna, the illegitimate son of an African slave and plantation owner. He gradually rose through the ranks of French society and became a brilliant violinist, composer, and champion fencer. He was also dubbed Chevalier de Saint-Georges. That's the French equivalent to a knighthood. Bologna begins as a child prodigy who rapidly excels in a number of disciplines. By adulthood, he's an expert swordsman and clearly has a gift for music. Bologna charms the court of Marie Antoinette, but catches the eye of aspiring singer Mary Josephine. Bologna has aspirations to lead the Paris Opera and must produce an opera himself to secure the position. He wants Mary Josephine to play a leading role. However, their ambitions and desire are thwarted by her cold and controlling husband, Marquis de Montebello. It's my film of the month, without a shadow of a doubt. It taught me something new. I love history, but I've never heard of Joseph Bologna. I'm embarrassed, but hey, I've been educated and informed. It's a wonderful film. But it will probably die a death. It won't last long in general release. It's the way things are. But an amazing film. And you feel wiser as a result. Brilliant. Wow. Absolutely loved it.
You heard it here first. That's Brian's film of the month. You know, and as you said, it probably will disappear fairly quickly. You know, even based on a couple of films we got left to review, you know kind of what's going to linger in the cinema.
Of course, yeah.
A film like this often won't get the time it deserves, but also, you know, we live in the land of streaming, so it won't be long before people are able to pick this up. And it does sound like a really fascinating film.
It's brilliant. I mean, again, maybe some people don't want a history lesson when they go to the movies. Maybe that's not what they want. But for me, it's a bonus to learn something I knew nothing about, and to be entertained by a really rich, compelling period drama. It's a treat for me. It really is. But again, we're all different. We all look for something different. But what I would urge listeners to do is to give it a chance and watch this film, because it's a marvelous film, and it probably won't get the attention that it deserves. But that's just the way things are. But I think one of the reasons why we have Film Club is that we can draw attention to films like this that may get overlooked.
Absolutely. There you go. Moving on swiftly to The Flash. You see what I did there?
Of course. Yeah, very good. Yeah.
Now, intrigued to hear what you think of this. Obviously, big title, big film, lots of promos and things like that. Would you say you're a superhero film fan, Brian?
No, I'm being absolutely truthful when I say that I'm not. But, you know, I am a film fan, full stop, and I will see whatever's out there. You know, my only qualm with Marvel and DC and franchising in general is the frequency of films in this genre, which tends to destroy the appeal. But, you know, I will watch what's out there and give it a fair crack of the whip, you know. But anyway, directed by Andy Muschietti, starring Ezra Miller, Sacha Cale, Michael Shannon, and a host of cameos that you will have great fun spotting as you go along. The storyline, Barry Allen is a forensic scientist on a mission to expose failings in the justice system. His father is languishing in jail following a miscarriage of justice. Henry Allen, was wrongly convicted of his mother's murder. When Barry was a child, however, a lab accident during a thunderstorm gave him special powers and a new alter ego. As the Flash, he becomes a member of the Justice League alongside Batman and Superman. But Barry is still tortured by his father's imprisonment. His superpowers enable him to go back in time, so why not alter events that led to his mother's death? He seeks counsel from Bruce Wayne, who warns him not to disturb the past. But since when did superheroes do as they're told? I really enjoyed this. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was good fun. I really enjoyed it. Visually, it's stunning to look at. And there's a really nice storyline cooking away in the background. And the breaks in the action allow you to absorb the storyline, which is good. As I said just now, I've been critical of franchising in the past, particularly DC and Marvel films. But as I said, I want to reiterate that I am a film fan full stop, and I will watch whatever's out there. There are just too many of these films being made. I read a stat recently that there have been 55 comic book movies. When they say comic books, you know, I believe they're talking about Marvel and DC films. There have been 55 films made in the last 10 years. And that, for me, is too much. It's too much. If there were one or two a year, I'd love it. I'd say it was brilliant. But it kind of, you know, when I ranked it, I gave it 3 stars. It lost a star for me because there are so many out there. There are so many films like this. Not only that, you've got this kind of continual diet of films on the big screen. You've also got the small screen as well. There's a Flash TV series. So there seems to be no let up. And I was convinced the bubble would burst, but it hasn't. You know, it seems to be more popular than ever. But I think for the sake of quality control, they should probably make fewer, which they'll never do because they make too much money. But I enjoyed it, though. I liked it a lot.
I think with the... Because I talk quite a lot about these films and stuff like that, and the fatigue that everyone has got through... Yeah, well, I think once Infinity War finished, I think everyone did feel a bit of like, oh, do you know what? We built towards that, and now everything else is just kind of aftermath. And like I say, pulling it into TV, it just felt like if you can't keep up with the unrelenting releases and staying on top of everything and all that stuff, that you were missing out. But I do feel that the quality has suffered. It's a quantity, not quality approach that they've got. And I've watched quite a few of the recent ones on Disney Plus, you know, watching the shows and the films and stuff, and none of them have the spark of intrigue that the films pre Infinity War had. Like going right the way back to like Iron Man, like, I was so into Iron Man. I loved Iron Man. I thought it was great. Then like you had all these characters, some of them were familiar and some weren't, but you kind of really got into it. But now it feels that it is just a machine pumping them out, and there's no heart there. There's no real attempt to make them joyful. It just feels like they know they've got a captured audience. They know people will watch it, and they know that, like you said earlier about a different film, you said, you know, of course the film is going to be all right. It's got a decent budget. Of course they're going to be able to pull it together and scrape a 3-star film together. But that is not what they should be trying to do. They should be trying to like elevate this above and make it better. But I don't know. I can't really get excited about them anymore, even with the non-stop cameos that are always quite funny. But
yeah, I think
it's not enough for me to actually really care about it. But it sounds at least that The Flash is worth a watch, though. Like it's a decent film.
I think so. I mean, I think you're a bigger fan. I think you're a bigger fan of the genre than I am. And as I said before, I will watch them, but I won't watch all of them because I feel like I've got the measure of it if I watch the trailer and I thought, oh, that's enough. But The Flash drew me in a bit more because it's got Batman in it. Right, anything with Batman is fine by me, you know. But you know, of course, it works. But again, like you say, it can leave you a bit cold. But the fact that someone like yourself, who is generally speaking a big fan, even you're getting slightly tired of them because there's just no variation. But they're only reacting to demand, right? I mean, what I always come back to is your local cinema. Look at your local cinema and see how many showings they have for a particular film, right? Something like The Flash, there'll be 25, 30 slots a day. For something like Chevalier, for example, or Greatest Days, there might be two or three. That tells you everything you need to know. The fact that they can still fill 10 or 15 screens with multiple showings every day for maybe 3 or 4 months, maybe longer, shows that people aren't getting tired of it. They can't be. By definition, they can't be. And I find that difficult to understand. I mean, surely we all get bored of something eventually, you know. You know, I mean, I couldn't watch too many films like Chevalier because I need to see something different. It's the same thing, you know.
I think that is the crucial element, though, is that when you're talking like a historic film and something dealing with something from the past, that it's always so different. I mean, I suppose the only thing that it is akin to would be like war films. Like, you know, how many films have we seen about World War II, and yet they still managed to bring new ones out that have we reviewed one on the very first film club, I think. All Quiet on the Western Front.
Yeah.
And which was a fascinating film. But like you said earlier, that actually, by maybe bringing out one or two a year, you're not being kind of bombarded with them. Whereas with this, it does feel like they just all feel the same. It just feels like mainstream pop. It's like they just, all right, we need another release. Release something else.
I know.
Much more thought to it than that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, if you look at next month, it's got to be a massive month, really, because we've got Indiana Jones, we've got Mission Impossible, Oppenheimer. But Mission Impossible and Indiana Jones are good examples of franchises that they don't, in my opinion at least, they don't flog too much. They'll leave a bit of a gap. With Indiana Jones, maybe 10, 15, 20 years or whatever. But even with Mission Impossible, though, they leave a gap of, say, 4 or 5 years before they do it again. You know,
and the quality is still there, but we'll get on to Mission Impossible. Yeah. But all right, well, let's move on from The Flash because they have enough time. They get enough screening, so let's not talk about them anymore.
No.
But I am very excited about this next film that you're going to review because it's Wes Anderson.
Oh, right.
Back with Asteroid City. Go for it, Brian.
Yeah, okay. So, directed by Wes Anderson, starring Jason Schwartzman, Tom Hanks, Scarlett Johansson, Bryan Cranston, Edward Norton, and many, 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 many.
Yeah, it goes
more.
On and on. That
it
cast
goes, is. Yeah, it goes on and on. But it's a fantastic cast. Take it as read. So the story, briefly, Asteroid City lies on the dust tracks of the Nevada desert and owes its existence to the aforementioned rock that once fell in the area. With a population of 87, the expected tourist expansion hasn't quite materialized. Roads have been left half built, and real estate is sold from a vending machine. One of the few attractions is a stargazing event and the occasional atom bomb test. A gloriously mixed bag of characters pass through, more by accident than design, and are caught in a strange turn of events. Everything is seen through the prism of a 1955 TV show broadcasting a play entitled Asteroid City. You know what, Chris? I think in years to come, historians will look back at the films of Wes Anderson and say Asteroid City is one of his best.
Wow.
It's a very, very good film. It's got all the classic hallmarks, quirky, offbeat characters. I love the way he uses colour, light and sound. The care taken over every shot, every frame is beautiful. It's exquisite. It really is. So it's up to Anderson's usual standard. In my opinion, it ranks with Grand Budapest Hotel. It's as good as that, the Royal Tenenbaums. It's one of his best. You kind of know what you're getting with Wes Anderson, but hey, what's wrong with that? Because you've got a beautifully made, almost work of art in front of you. It's lovely. It's a lovely film. And it's very funny in places as well.
I think you're right about the colour. Like, colour for me, like, as soon as you see a poster for a Wes Anderson film, you know it's his, because you're like, no one else uses that type of palette and that type of vibrancy. I think it has that almost nostalgic quality of film. Absolutely. And you know, transporting you to maybe like a different time, but not in a cynical way or anything like that. He's so kind of like, you know, Grand Budapest Hotel, it's got that offbeat charm that you just no one else can create that. No one else can even come close, which is why he attracts so many people to his films. Yeah. It's like, well, the poster for this. I saw the poster for this on the tube. Where was I? London Bridge, I think. And it was, I was just there for a good minute, just reading all the names that were in it. I thought, oh, brilliant.
You see, the thing is, that gives you an idea of the status that Wes Anderson has. Because if the Hollywood glitterati know that Wes Anderson's making a film, you know, they're going to be on the phone to their agents and say, I want a part in this. Even if it's only 2 or 3 minutes, I want a part in it. And you can see why. You can see why. You know, there are so many great little cameos that kind of just capture you. Bryan Cranston plays the host of the TV show, right? And he plays it in the style of Ed Murrow, you know, the old American 1950s TV interviewer. He plays it like that, and it kind of fades to black and white when he comes back in. And at one point in the film, Scarlett Johansson's there talking to one of the other characters, and they both look to their right, and they think, and it's Bryan Cranston in colour, and he said, should I be here? And they both go, no. Oh, okay. And he dodges off again, and it's great. I love those little kind of subtle sort of visual gags that are just gently ticking over. You know, it's great. I love it. I love this sort of thing. And it's a film that deserves to be seen. And you have to see this on a big screen. Have to. Because it will lose something. All films do, but this film particularly is so important for you to see on a big screen.
Well, if that isn't enough to get you going, I don't know what would. So those are the cinema releases that we're covering for this month. Thank you, Brian, for going to see all those. Sounds like mostly a pleasure for you.
Yeah, to be fair, with one notable exception. But, that's what I'm prepared to do for Film Club. You see, I will suffer.
Yeah, you've got a headache from it. You
know, I've got a headache, I know, I've got a headache. I push the boundaries, me. Yeah.
So whilst Brian was out doing all that, working really hard and traipsing across London to different screenings, I sat at home and just watched Extraction 2 on the sofa.
Right.
So I have seen this. Have you seen this, Brian?
Yes, I have. And I saw Extraction 1 as well.
Had you seen it before, or did you watch it for this?
No, I watched it for this because I started to watch Extraction 2, and the opening frames, it was obvious it was following on from Extraction 1. So I thought, why not? It's there. It's on Netflix. I'll see Extraction 1 first. And I followed it with Extraction 2. So
I think it's worthwhile because, like you say, it's easy to sort of just catch up. And there's a few elements that are kind of being mentioned in the second film that pertain to that first one. So it's worthwhile. But for those who don't know the Extraction world, it stars Chris Hemsworth, if you haven't seen him splashed all over your Netflix screen, who plays Tyler Rake, a particularly talented soldier or ex-soldier who has a penchant for being able to recover people from very, very difficult situations. In the first film, a little bit of a spoiler, so if you haven't seen the first one, maybe skip forward a couple of minutes. He manages to complete his mission, but essentially you think he's dead at the end because he kind of gets shot a few times and falls off a bridge. Which I think that would be enough to do me in. I don't think I'd come back from that. What about you, Brian? Reckon you'd survive that one?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, we know how resilient the human body could be, but I mean, I'm only a mere mortal. I don't think
I mean, sometimes anyone... I struggle to get up if I've slept funny, so I'm not sure bullet wounds and falling from bridges is my bag, really.
You know what? When we get to Extraction 5 or 6, and I'm sure we will get there, I think we'll find out that Tyler Rake is a robot or AI or something. Or
was he dreaming like Ben Affleck?
Yeah, could be. Maybe it was all a dream, because how does anyone survive any of that?
So he does come back at the beginning of 2, and... has a sort of long period of rehabilitation, lots of working out scenes. They felt quite retro, actually, him doing the old push-ups and all that stuff. It felt like a throwback to like Rocky or something.
I suppose there is that kind of vibe going on there, isn't there? Yeah.
And then he's sort of stronger than ever, really. And then he is kind of struggling with his new chapter, I guess, because he didn't really know where he's going, but... turns out there is a mission that he should get involved with, because I believe it's like his sister-in-law or something. Trying to work out the connection. His sister-in-law has been living inside a prison with her family because she's married to a mobster who has to be there, but he's got such clout in the country that he's able to sort of keep his family in there with him.
That's it. That's about the size of it, I think.
So Tyler Rake's mission is to go in and extract the mum and her two kids.
Yep.
Get them away from this mobster, as well as all the gangs and everything else within the prison, and get them to safety. And as you can imagine, all hell unfolds. Yeah. Brian, what did you think of Extraction 2?
Well, the C word springs to mind.
Which one?
No, not that one. And not that one either. I was thinking competent. You know, I bet you're relieved, aren't you?
I was very relieved. I thought, he's not going there, is he?
No. Competent is a word that always springs to mind with a film like this, because they're very well put together. You know, they must have some really elaborate story balls to work out every move, every combat scene. It's brilliantly staged, but it does feel a bit like an action movie by numbers to me. You know, that it's not really offering you anything new. You know, you've got a very vague backstory that's a theme running through both films. That's why it's advisable to see the first one. There is a very faint sort of backstory running through the fact that he is an army veteran. He's a commando, a veteran of the Afghanistan conflict, I think.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And it just all seems a bit too predictable, you know, that particularly if you've seen the first one as well, you know, that you think, well, he's going to get through this. And he does it literally single-handed. In fact, at one point, I know we're talking about the second one, but in the first film, his arm's in a sling for part of the time. And he's managing to fight 30 or 40 assailants off. But then again, he's tied a rake, isn't he? I think we're beginning to discover a new superhero. But look, it works. It does the job. But there's something missing there for me. It's not really giving you anything that's different or original. You know, the fact that Tyler Rake is an army veteran, you know, why not make a film about a real-life army veteran? Someone like Johnson Behari, for example, the guy that won the VC in the Gulf, the Iraqi War. Now, Netflix were going to make a film based on his book, but it didn't get anywhere. Instead, Netflix are putting their money into a film like this that's going to make money. It is. Again, it goes back to giving people what they want. This is what people want to see. Having said that, it's not really doing anything that we haven't seen before, although it's very competent and it's very well done. But you could say that about a lot of films, Chris.
Yeah, I think I enjoyed it more than you. It is predictable, and it is, you have to suspend disbelief. You know, he would have never made it through the things that he makes it through. I think what I liked more about it was that you've given some very, very good set pieces. I mean,
good. Definitely.
I tell you what actually impacted my viewing of this film. There was two things that impacted it. First off, I saw a 1-star review for it on The Guardian, and I thought, oh, me and Brian are reviewing this. Like, oh gosh, like, you know, 1-star.
I don't think it's that bad.
I think that was very harsh. And so I think I went in with very sort of low expectation, thinking, gosh, yeah. Yeah, that must have been terrible. But it's nowhere near as bad as they made it sound. The second thing was about this whole, there's a very, very long shot action sequence during the prison scene.
Yeah.
And it's like a one-take-esque thing, and the camera's roving with him. I did notice as soon as it kicked in, I was like, oh, it's they're doing that. The camera's going to follow them now.
Yeah.
And I actually thought that was really good. I thought, yeah, I'm always impressed when filmmakers try something like that because it's ambitious, it's interesting, you know, I like that. I think the best one I ever saw was in The Raid. I think The Raid did it.
Right.
And there's a fight scene. If you haven't seen The Raid, I 100% recommend it. It's amazing. And that is actually something that puts this in its shadow. You know, The Raid is like up there, top tier action.
Yeah.
If that's what you like, then watch The Raid. But with this, it's got Chris Hemsworth, and I don't think, you know, he's not doing his usual sort of Thor shtick. Like, it's not full of loads of like one-liners and things like that. It's more, he is kind of playing it more down to earth. I think it's probably falling more on the side of drama than it should do. Like, it's trying to be a bit too serious at times, because, you know, when you've got a character that does just get back up all the time, you sort of think like, all right, well, it's pastiche now, you're in the land of like Fast and the Furious where you know, everyone should be dead. But they kind of try and say this is more serious than it was, and I don't know, but I do think there's an element here of like, do you know what, if you're gonna do an action film, as you say, make it competent, make it something that you are, it's going to hold together for the most part. I do think this one does suffer from chapterness. Like, it kind of, I try not to give it away, but they, all right, listeners, it's a bit of a spoiler here, but so they get out of the prison and that happens. And then they have another sort of run in. And it's like almost like moving from chapter to chapter of like, oh, really? Oh, they're doing it again?
Like, yeah, I know.
Whereas you sort of think, just go and hide. Like, why are you doing
that? I know.
And that kind of got to me a little bit. And then, yeah, there's lots of stuff where you're watching it going, well, surely the police would be here by now. Like, where are they?
I know.
It's fun and it's mindless and...
Yeah.
There's an element of emotional depth there, like, because you find out a bit more about him and his son and things like that. I think that was kind of lended a bit more to it. But there's certainly not enough here to make it extraordinary.
Yeah. I think what's interesting, though, is that the backstory is beginning to unravel slightly. So in Extraction 2, you learn more about Tyler Rake than you did in Extraction 1. So possibly with subsequent films, you know, more of that story will open up. That's what I'd like to see it do. You know, I always preach the story. You know, it's storytelling. Any film, you make any film, you're telling a story, right? And I like to see the story breathe more amongst all the action. You know, like with The Flash, right? They let the story breathe. You know, there was a break in the action. You had some narrative. You pick up the story. You invest in the characters more. That's what I'd like to see. I think as a franchise, it has potential, but they need to let the story breathe a bit more. And I think there's a lot more to Tyler Rake as a character that they can bring out. And they're starting to do that in the second one. So I think it's showing some promise, but there is something very predictable about it, and that there isn't anything there we haven't seen before. But, you know, that might be a trifling point for most people.
There's also that element of... generational gaps, right? Because these films feel very familiar. Actually, funnily enough, you mentioned like Mission Impossible earlier and things like that, but there's always going to be those generations of, you know, viewers coming along, and for them this might be the first action film they've ever seen. And you think, because Chris Hemsworth in it, maybe they saw him in the superhero films and they're like, oh, what's he in? It's a very like well put together film, and it does a lot of the stuff that action movies did, you know, back in the days of like Arnie and stuff like that. You know, well, it's doing that, I think.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you made a very good point there. I was just going to say that the template for a film like Extraction could be Commando or it could be Rambo, couldn't it, very easily. So you can trace the lineage back to there. So this type of film is nothing new, right? But it's adding a modern perspective. It's giving it a contemporary spin. But the principles on which this film is based were the same as for Rambo or Commando or any of those big action movies back then, you know.
They always had that cheeky element, right? There was always a slight cheeky element in those films where it was a bit funny, like
there's humor there.
I think a lot of these modern action films don't do that for fear of it being sent up like Arnie films were, like made fun of. But I think they're fun. I think that's what I want.
That's the idea of them, though. You know, I don't think these films are meant to be taken seriously. So if you give an action hero like Tyler Rake the odd funny line here and there, you know, give him a sense of humour. Make the character more likable and make the brand more likable as well. You know, that only makes sense. It's got to be tongue-in-cheek. You know, any action hero is tongue-in-cheek. You're not meant to take it that seriously. So I think that's okay. You can do that.
Well, I'm pretty sure it's been confirmed that there's more of these films to come, and there's a section in the film with, I'm not going to say the actor's name, but a certain character turns up. I think there's going to be more of these sort of films. So I will definitely watch 3 if it comes out. But for now, Extraction 2 is available to anyone who wants to watch it on Netflix. And as Brian has done, you can also watch the first just to catch up if you haven't seen them. Okay, that's streaming. We're going to move on now to some indie films because that's what we love doing at UK Film Review. We love championing these filmmakers who pour their blood, sweat and tears into their movies, and we come along and just chat about them but these films were suggested to us by the filmmakers themselves. They've asked us to review them, and we will always be kind here. We're not gonna tear them apart, and we're also often seeing films that are really great and they're available to watch often online. So we're going to review 2 short films in this section. The first, written and directed by Matt Johns, is A Father's Day. Have you seen this, Brian?
I have seen it, yes.
Terrific. Why don't you give the synopsis on this one?
Right, well, this appears to be a take on the zombie character Walking Dead. That's the vibe I got straight away from this film. And it begins with quite a graphic scene of some zombies feeding on a corpse. And a relationship slowly develops between a boy and a girl who are both zombies. They're walkers. They belong to that breed, if you like. And as the film wears on, it begins to become apparent that they're showing some affection towards each other. And it does give you an idea of how zombies might mate. What is the mating ritual? Now, whereas back in the day, you know, a guy would give a girl sort of chocolates and flowers. But here, you know, he gives her a severed hand, like you do. But very clever, very cleverly put together. But the way it ends kind of surprises me a little bit. And I'm still not entirely certain where Father's Day comes in.
I was just saying, because I was really enjoying you like give your synopsis. And I'm sat here thinking, oh, Brian doesn't know the key factor here.
No, I don't. Now,
I didn't know this until I looked up on IMDb that the girl that he sees in the beginning when he's feasting is his daughter. It's not a mating thing. He's her father. And they've unexpectedly found each other. Now, and so he then takes her on this day, like they go to the park. And as you say, like he pushes the bone back in, like when she hurts her arm and stuff. And they're having like this day together, even though they're zombies and they've sort of forgotten about eating corpses. Yeah.
Now, I would never have read it that way. You know, it draws you in, you draw conclusions. I didn't read the write-up, I saw it cold. But now I thought the father, you know what I thought the father would have been? I thought the father was a guy with a rifle at the end.
Yeah, and I think there's obviously the parallel that he's there protecting his daughter, and then the zombie dad is also... To be fair, I didn't know that they were related, the zombies. I thought maybe it was just, he was just harbouring, you know, these kind of paternal feelings and happened to just want to protect this younger female zombie because he was maybe a dad before. But yeah, apparently I think they were reunited as fathers. But as I say, maybe it doesn't need to be clarified. Maybe it is an element you can take what you want from it.
Well,
it but could, there is a definite paternal element to the film.
But they look about the same age, though, the boy and the girl. Again, just my sort of take on it. You know.
Yeah, I do see what you mean. The casting there is a bit confusing because he's not. Yeah, it's not sort of definitive. Like, I think if he was sort of like visibly a lot older, and then she was maybe younger, then I think it would be a bit clearer.
Now,
but
yeah. Now I would have thought. You see, this is the way I was thinking. I would have thought the father was the guy with the rifle, and the guy that was with the girl at the beginning was his target for whatever reason. See, I'm making up my own stories here. But no, look, it was very well put together, very well observed, you know, but I got something completely different from it. You know, but again, I didn't read the write-up. So very well done, though. Very well done.
It's got a fantastic production quality to it. It really reminded me of like Shaun of the Dead sort of levels of modern zombie films, but it wasn't trying to be very funny. Like there wasn't a lot of, well, there wasn't really any comedy in it, but there was bits that were kind of like, oh, that's sort of funny, like in terms of, like you said, giving a hand, or when he pushes the bone back in, but it being like a really tender moment between the two of them. But I really enjoyed the fact that the quality of the film was very high, because when it comes to zombie films, actually the next one we're going to review is also a zombie film, that it can really impact your enjoyment of it, because it's so reliant on things like great sound. You know, the noises need to be sort of terrifying, the makeup needs to be obviously on point, and I think with the Father's Day they've done such an incredible job. The film just looks great, and I would have happily watched a feature of this. I would have stuck around for more of this.
The opening scene, as I say, was quite graphic, but I mean it looked real.
Yeah It was really good, really,
you know,
good.
The to me, they've spent a lot on getting that right, of getting it to look right. So, you know, given the due, it's very well put together. And they couldn't have had a huge budget for this, could they, really?
No, and often I'm surprised what people can do with small amounts of money. It's estimated 10K, which is, you know, it's big for a short, but
that's
what they
bad.
Do with that is actually they do a lot, and it looks the part. And like I say, I think when you watch a film like this and you want to watch more, that is a true test that it's great. And it came out quite a while ago. It came out in 2016, but it is available on YouTube. That's where we watched it. I don't know if it was, I think it was on the Alter platform, Alter. They've got like a YouTube channel. So you can go on, I mean, they've got tons of great short films on there, but look for A Father's Day, because anyone that's like a fan of this genre, and as you mentioned some absolute classics earlier, this does stand up with them. It says, look, this is a great piece. It's a great short film. And I think it playing on this, funny enough, I watched that TV show recently. Oh gosh, the name escapes me right now, because it was based on a game where he, you know, this becomes a father-daughter sort of journey, even though they're not actually related, in a post-apocalyptic world. That playing on that element, you know, because they're protective kind of role that a father would play in this type of environment, it really works. I think it was brilliantly done, and I'd really recommend it if people can find it. And as I've mentioned, we're moving on to another zombie-esque film with short film Beware. Did you get this to watch this?
Yeah,
one as well,
I saw this,
So a short one, really short, 5 minutes. And from the team at Massive Badgers, which is, I mean, that's scary enough, isn't
it?
Thinking of that.
That's a bit intimidating, though, isn't it?
I think we've reviewed a few Massive Badgers films over the years, and they got in touch about this short, Beware. The setup is that there's a couple driving in the car, and their sat nav is kind of warning them that something is up ahead, and it says Beware. The man of the relationship doesn't seem to be too bothered, whereas the woman is. But they come across a car stalled by the side of the road, and they get out and help. And turns out they're zombies. And the man becomes a zombie pretty quickly, leaving the woman to sort of run and escape and try and elude them. She then falls into what I think is a time traveling hole and ends up in the 60s. Is that what you got from this, Brian?
Yeah, I think so, more or less. It's. I mean, you can tell from my description of the first film that, you know, my first impressions of a film like this aren't necessarily the right ones, intended by the filmmakers. But yeah, I think that was the idea of it. It's so short, though. I mean, it's very difficult to get for a filmmaker to make all their points in 4 minutes. But I think this is deliberately funnier. It tries to be a bit zanier and a bit more off the wall. Whereas Father's Day is a more earnest and a more serious take on the subject matter. But yeah, it was good. It was good fun. They looked like they had a great time making it, as much as anything else.
Yeah, I think there's ambition, and then there's trying to do a zombie time travel film in 5 minutes. Like, I think that's not really what they were trying to do here. I think they were just having fun and experimenting, which is absolutely fine. Yeah, you can't go into this film expecting to be really fulfilled in terms of what they're presenting, but there are elements to it that are just sort of, it'll make you laugh, I think. Yeah, I think it's more funny than anything else. Yeah. I think
it's a useful promo, isn't it? It's a showcase for the work. That's the way you'd look at it. But it's kind of like a snippet. It's a vignette, isn't it, of what they could do if they had, you know, a bigger scale, if they scaled it up more. So, you know, it was good fun. It was good fun. I like the setup and the concept of sat-nav telling them something extra that they might, that wouldn't ordinarily know about. So yeah, it's good fun. It works, you know. It does the job. You know, it's doing it. And yeah, good luck to them. I'd like to see them do something on a bigger, slightly bigger scale, though.
I think and something maybe a little bit more kind of confined. I think trying to do so much, it does. It has that aspect of you feeling a little bit short change from it, that you're like, what was this not going anywhere at all? Like, it didn't really sort of land anywhere that I wanted it to. But like you say, I think you're there for the laughs, really. And also, I think they're trying a few things out. Often, I think with filmmakers, they want to do things and try some scenes. Maybe they've just got something in their head, they just want to get it out, and they've done it. And we live in that world now where people can do that.
There is an experimental element to a short film, though, isn't there? There always will be. And it is trying out a concept, a plan, an idea, you know, and all well and good. And if you get something reasonably coherent from that, then it's job done, isn't it, really? You know, and it's drawing attention to their work. So I'm all for that. You know, it's a testing ground, isn't it? You know, these are directors trying to cut their teeth in a very competitive field on a limited budget. But good for them.
You know, again, available on YouTube. If you go search for Massive Badgers, you could probably get some fun YouTube videos there.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, mind what you find when you when you Google that. Yeah,
yeah. But filter for channels, and you'll find Beware. If not, we'll try and post a link to it somewhere so that you can watch it. As I say, it's 5 minutes. It's a bit of fun, and I think it's worth it sometimes with indie filmmakers who do like good stuff. They try and get stuff out there, and that works.
Yeah.
I don't think it's as good as Father's Day. I think you're chalk and cheese there. Really.
Yeah, it's the better of the two. It's more ambitious, isn't it? Even though it's got twice the amount of time. I think Father's Day was 9 minutes, wasn't it? I think 9 or 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But it shows how productively you can use that screen time, and it leaves a bigger impression straight away. So. But, you know.
Especially considering, I don't think there's any dialogue, is there, in Father's Day?
No, there isn't. Well, a few grunts.
A few grunts, yeah.
That's about it.
Yeah. I think, they do a lot emotionally as well. So, But both worth checking out. And weirdly, that we've ended up reviewing two zombie films. I did not even know. I just get sent these films, so I think, I'll just put these two together.
I thought you did that. You know, intentionally, Chris.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I think I did. Yeah, I think I was that organised, and I was that.
Let's say you were.
Yeah. On to another zombie film. I'm joking. We are going to review our nostalgia pick. Now, this is a film from... We haven't really set a clear timeline for what's considered a nostalgia pick, but for this, we're going back to the year I was born, you know, wow. 1988.
Really?
So, you know, Brian was a chirpy, 75-year-old at that point?
What was I? What was I back then? I would have been 23 back then.
So
23.
Yeah, probably the same age as Tom Hanks.
Roughly. I think he's maybe a year or two older. Yeah.
Yeah. If you haven't seen Big, it's on Disney Plus. We're going to review it now. And this was a film I remember my brother watching a lot when I grew up. And it was a film that I kind of knew here and there. But I wouldn't say I was infatuated with it, but it certainly did remind me of childhood because it was on and, you know, because my brother would watch it. I was a big Tom Hanks fan anyway. I like Tom Hanks films, especially from this sort of period. You had said, I think you'd only seen it once. Was that right, Brian?
Yeah, I saw it when it was first out. And I don't believe I've seen it since until now. But I think it's a good thing in some ways because it's a film that I feel I know well because it's from the 80s. And I think the 80s was a very distinct period for filmmaking. For popular culture, it's very distinct. But I'd only seen it the once. But seeing it again, it's kind of grown on me. I think it's better than I remember it. I think you picked some great films for the nostalgia slot, Chris, by the way. For me, this is a fascinating time capsule from the 80s. You know, personal computers that filled up the room, those huge white boxes that used to be cutting-edge technology, you know. The radio rental market was just getting off the ground back then. It just puts it in some historical context. But I love the film, though. I really like this film. It's so bright and clever, you know. Tom Hanks and Elizabeth Perkins are perfect in their respective roles. I like the setup. You know, Josh is this 14-year-old boy. He's sweet on a girl. Just as he gets to be alone with her, he's not big enough to go on the fairground, right? So what does he do? It's obvious what you do, isn't it? You go to a fortune-telling machine and you say, I wish I was big. I wish I was big enough to get on the fairground, right? And he wakes up as Tom Hanks, doesn't he? And I think in some ways you've got to suspend your disbelief a little bit. Again, it's that phrase, isn't it? You know, suspend your disbelief and just imagine what it would be like if you were a 14-year-old living in the body of an adult, right? So you get over the minor sort of aspects of the plot that link everything together. He is trying to live in an adult world. He's got a job working at I think it's a toy factory, isn't it? Or a toy design company. And two leading characters, Tom Hanks and Elizabeth Perkins. Elizabeth Perkins' character, Susan, is the office vamp, scheming office vamp, who falls in love, basically, with Josh. And she, as their relationship develops, he makes her a lot softer, a lot kinder. He makes her a better person. And I like that. I just think Penny Marshall was a great director. And she would pin down these roles so well and pull something out really meaningful in the storyline. You know, lots of great scenes. Great lines as well. You know, towards the end when Josh is kind of getting upset and he's saying to Susan, I want to go home to my family. And she says, I knew it. You're married, right? I'm a child in a man's body. Oh, all men are children in a man's body. You know, I love those parallel conversations that are progressing side by side. And they both think there's something totally different. I think it's a really nice film. And I think it's grown, it's aged well as a film. I like
it. Yeah, it has that defining 80s quality of it that it is very sort of warm and fluffy. And it has the appeal of like, childhood and things being quite a lot simpler. It's a much simpler time. The dramatic irony works really well because, you know, obviously we know what's going on and seeing the people who don't, like you say, with those lines that he's given. But one of my favorites was when she wants to come back to his apartment and he's obviously for a sleepover, and she's and he goes, what? Yeah. He's like, I'm on top, and he needs the bunk beds, right? And it's things like that which are just pure like comedy from a great place. And these films also they predate the internet or like the mass use of the internet. And they make it more realistic, because like if you tried to make this film in 2023, it just wouldn't make sense because there's just too much, you know, communication and information available. Because what I thought was really hilarious as well is like, you know, he's because when he wakes up the next day, his mum is there. She's like, oh my god, like, you know, she's been, you know, that someone, this man's in the house,
and
her son goes missing essentially, but he gets away with it. He's like, kind of gets away and leaves, and then the boy's friend kind of helps him out, comes and sort of looks out, but no one's tailing him, you know, no one's looking you know, for him or looking for the boy.
I mean, you need you need to overlook a hole in the plot, really, because there is a hole in the plot between him going missing as a child and the adult version of him going into the New York City to get this job. And in the story, he's kind of, he speaks to his mum on the phone, he writes to her and convinces her that he's being held captive, but everything's fine, you know, and he'll be back soon. That is a massive hole in the plot if you want to be ultra critical, right? But we don't need to, right? We believe in it. We buy into these characters. We believe it's happening. And that's a tribute to the director. It's a tribute to the writers and the actors that are involved. I think Tom Hanks and Elizabeth Perkins were excellent together. They work well together. What I think is interesting about this film, though, is that you've got Tom Hanks and Elizabeth Perkins, whose career trajectories have followed a completely different path. You know, Tom Hanks's career is stratospheric, isn't it? It's gone from strength to strength. Elizabeth Perkins has still got a career. You know, she's still making films. She does a lot of TV work these days, but she hasn't become the huge star that Tom Hanks went on to become. Bearing in mind that her contemporaries are Julia Roberts and Demi Moore, it's surprising.
Yeah, I think Hanks had clearly, you know, picked some amazing roles. You know, you look at his, you could have countless episodes of a podcast dedicated just to the films of Tom Hanks. You know? Elizabeth Perkins, for me, I only really ever remember her from two films, and they're both Christmas related. I think she was in The Grinch, one of the versions of The Grinch, and she's in Miracle on 34th Street, the remake. And I think it's funny, and funny enough, John Hurd is in this film as well, who's from the Home Alone film. So I, weirdly that I kind of put this all together. But it's funny how you see these actors back then, you sort of think, oh, the trajectory of their careers must be going in the same kind of way.
You think so.
They're
you?
Really not. You know, and often it's very, very different. So
I mean, I suppose it could depend on a lot of factors. You know, as you say, Tom Cruise again. I'm thinking about Mission Impossible. I think
you're obsessed.
I know. But Tom Hanks, you know, has chosen the right films. You know, possibly they were there waiting for him anyway, but it is about making the right choices, isn't it, I guess? You know, the only other film I can remember Elizabeth Perkins being in off the top of my head was The Flintstones. You know, and it...
She was in that,
Yeah, and it doesn't, you know, her body of work isn't what it should be, because I think she's a good actor. You know, and that part she played in big isn't as easy as you think it is. You know, it's not as easy a part to handle. You know, they both make it look easy. But that's what good actors do. They can make difficult parts look easy.
There we go. So that's Big, available on Disney Plus currently. It may change by the time you're hearing this, especially if you're hearing this way in the future. If you're listening to this, you know, the world's gone to pot, Disney Plus has crumbled, but the only thing left is this podcast, then it's not available, but we have gone through the film, so at least you can feel like you've seen it.
You've heard the best bit. You've heard the best bits, at least.
Oh, yeah, for sure. We are going to have a different film for next month's nostalgia pick. I've already picked it because I've wanted to rewatch this, and I've kind of been building myself up to it because as a kid, it absolutely terrified me. I'm going to play the game where I get Brian to guess it.
Oh, good then.
I love doing this.
If you must.
I'm just going to give you like a couple of clues. So it's a Spielberg film. So that's big hint.
Yeah.
From 1975. That's all I'm giving you so far.
1975. Oh. Is it Close Encounters?
Oh, no.
Oh, I know. I know. Jaws.
Yes.
Jaws.
Jaws. Yeah. Yeah, I think I've only seen this film maybe once or twice because I found it just, as a kid, it really shook me up. I now have a fear of open water. Like, that is, for me, the scariest thing I could do if someone just left me in the middle of open water. Like, not good. So it's on Netflix at the moment. We're going to watch and review Jaws on next month's pod. Yep. So if you haven't seen it, watch it. If you have seen it, watch it again. Brian, have you seen Jaws?
Yeah, I've seen Jaws many times over the years. It's the type of film that's very watchable. Again, because of the storyline, because really it was quite groundbreaking at the time. And a great cast. You know, you've got Robert Shaw, you've got Roy Scheider, Richard Dreyfuss. Top cast. And something that at the time when it was made had never been made before. No, you know, we'd never seen anything like this before. So it's that kind of film. It's a modern classic. And it's probably the film that I think brought Spielberg to people's attention. He'd been making films. He'd made films before that. You know, he made Jewel in 1971, which was his first feature-length film. But so he'd been making films for 3 or 4 years, but this was the one that really made him, you know, a mega director. They put him out there. So it'd be interesting to watch that film again, just to see exactly what it was that broke him in such a major way. But great film, though.
There we go. So Jaws for next month. Brian, do you want to give us a little taste of what you might be watching?
Reviewing? I mean, three definites. New Indiana Jones film, new Mission Impossible film, and also Oppenheimer with Cillian Murphy, which is the new Christopher Nolan film. Which has, you know, Christopher Nolan has a kind of a history inextricably linked with UK Film Review podcast because he was the subject of the very first podcast we did.
Yeah, and you know, Ian loves Christopher Nolan, so I'm sure he's listening with intrigue to see what's going to happen next. But yeah, no, looking forward to all those. And yeah, we'll be doing some indie films. We'll be doing a streaming pick as well. So do come back for that episode. And thank you again, Brian, for your terrific reviews of all the great films. And thank you to the listeners. Thank you also to the other UK Film Review podders. There's some other shows out there. Do go and listen to them on our channel, wherever you listen to them, you know, Spotify, iTunes, whatever. It's really, really great to connect with you all. So thank you if you listen and are a regular. Thank you also if you reviewed the show. We've had some nice reviews on Spotify. If you haven't left one yet, please do. It really means a lot to our team. And yeah, we'll be back again next month with another episode. That's it for now.
Bye for now.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kyler Tsinis.
I'm Kayla Tsinis, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.